On war, the king told him. That makes no sense, said the dwarf. It does, lad, if you have a mind dark enough to examine it. Ballistar awoke with a start, and sat up blinking and afraid. He had failed Sigani and slept. Swiftly he rushed to her side. She was warm to the touch and sleeping deeply. Relieved, the dwarf knelt by the fire and blew the coals to glowing life, adding shreds of bark to feed the tiny flames. Once it had flared, he placed two small logs atop the coals. From Sigani's pack, he took a flat-bottomed pot and a sack of dried oats. Filling the pot with snow, he stood it upon the fire. Despite being full of snow, it melted to only a tiny amount of water, and Ballistar spent some time moving back and forth, bringing handfuls of snow from outside the cave. When the pot was half full of water, he added oats and a pinch of salt. The sun was up, the cave mouth lit with golden light. Birdsong could be heard from the trees outside, and the air was fresh with the promise of the coming spring. Sigani awoke and stretched. The blanket slid from her naked body. "Ah, breakfast," she said. "What a fine companion you are, Ballistar." "I live to serve my queen," he said, making an elaborate bow. "No sign of Taliesin?" "Not yet, but the dawn has only just arrived." Using two long sticks, Ballistar lifted the pot from the fire and stirred the contents, which had thickened considerably. "You brought no honey," he chided her. "Porridge is bland and tasteless without it."
"I had to carry enough food for two. Come to think of it, I had to carry you as well for a while. There was no room for honey."
"Have you slept?"
"A little," he admitted.
She smiled. "The next time I suggest a swim under the ice, be so kind as to remind me of my previous stupidity."
"I will. How are you feeling?"
"Rested. And at peace for the first time in weeks. No plans to study, no quarrels to adjudicate, no ruffled feathers to smooth. Just breakfast at dawn in a peaceful cave, enjoying good company."
"I trust you include me in that description," said Taliesin,
stepping into the cave and brushing snow from his tattered cloak of feathers. Sigani nodded, but her smile had faded.
"Welcome, Taliesin."
The old man made his way to the fire and sat.
"You have a beautiful body, Sigarni. 50 years ago it would have inspired me to carnal thoughts. Now, however, I can appreciate its beauty on an entirely different level. I take it the Palades asks for the crown."
Sigarni nodded and rose from the bed, dressing swiftly.
"It will not be easy. Yet you must not dally," continued Taliesin. "I will send you through the gateway as soon as you're dressed." "The world beyond is poisonous," said Ballistar coldly. "She could die there."
Taliesin swung to him.
"It is very rare that I'm surprised, dwarf, yet you have accomplished it. How is it that you know of your veil?" "I am a creature of legend," said Ballistar with a wide grin. "I know many things." "Then perhaps you would like to continue my story."
"Gladly," said Ballistar, who then told Sigani all that Ironhand had confided to him the night before. The dwarf took great pleasure in the look of amazement that Taliesin sought to disguise. When he had finished, Ballistar moved to Sigani's pack, pulling out two shallow bowls. Ladling porridge into each, he passed one to Sigani.
"You are welcome to eat from the pot," he told Taliesin. "I am not hungry," snapped the wizard. "Is there anything else you wish to add about your veil?"
"No," said Ballistar happily.
"Do continue."
The wizard cast him a baleful glance.
"Your veil was once a paradise. There was no physical ugliness there, and no natural disease. At least no disease that affects the inhabitants. It was a land of beauty and light. Now it is the opposite. It is an ocean world, with a very small landmass at the equator. The landmass has two great cities, and these are in a perpetual state of war. The war is necessary for reasons we do not need to trouble ourselves with. The Krenn is in a temple at the center of the city of Zervak. It is a city under siege, and you will need to enter it by means of a black river which flows through it. Do not drink the water. It is being polluted by volcanic ash. The city's inhabitants have a way of purifying the water, involving filters. Once inside the city, the water you find will be good to drink. Take food with you, and eat nothing offered you during your stay, no matter how appetizing it looks.
How'd I get there? Asked Sigani.
There is a gateway close to the falls. I will send you through, and you will arrive at a point some 7 miles south of the city. Since you will not see the sun, you must head for a set of twin peaks you will see to the north. When you return to the gateway, you will make a cut upon your arm and allow blood to drop on each of the 6 standing stones that make up the circle. I will then bring you back.
Bring us back, put in Ballistar. I go alone, said Sigani.
Ballistar was about to argue when Taliesin cut in. I agree with him, said Taliesin with a rare smile. Take the dwarf. He will be of use.
Ballistar was surprised.
Why do you support me, wizard? I know you have no love for me. Perhaps that is why I support you, said Taliesin. Have you brought weapons?
Yes, said Sigani. Bows, knives, and my saber.
Good. Now, if you're both ready, we should depart.
Sigani took a small pouch from her pack and dropped the finger bone of Iron Hand into it. Looping a thong through the pouch, she tied it around her neck.
What is that?
Asked Taliesin. A talisman, she told him.
Ballistar thought he was about to speak, but Taliesin said nothing. The wizard rose.
When you have cleaned and stowed your pots, I will be waiting for you on the other side of the pool, he said, and padded out of the cave.
Are you sure you want to come with me, Bali? Asked Sigani.
Always, he said.
They found Taliesin waiting by a cliff face some 200 yards from Iron Hand's burial place. Sigani had played there as a child, and she and her friends had often debated the meaning of the strange symbols carved on the rocks. The area was flat, as if smoothed by man, and deep grooves had been chiselled from the rock in the shape of a tall rectangular door. There was also evidence of an inscription, though wind and rain, snow and hail had long since eroded the greater part of it.
This is one of the lesser gateways, said Taliesin. It does not allow movement through our time, but does serve to open time doorways to other realities. Now, remember what I said. Do not drink of the water of the Black River, nor eat any meat offered to you. This is vital. I knew a sorcerer once who went there and ate a little pork. It swelled inside him and ripped him apart. Your vale is a world of great magic, and you are strangers to it. Because of your very strangeness, its power will be many times greater around you. Bear this in mind. Now, you know where you're heading?
7 miles towards the Twin Peaks, said Sigani.
Good. Now my bones are freezing here, so let us begin. Are you ready?
Sigani nodded, and Taliesin turned to Ballistar.
And you, dwarf, there is still time to change your mind. What awaits you is not pleasant. Your worst nightmare is beyond this gate.
Ballistar thought he detected a note of concern in the wizard's voice, and felt his fears rise.
I will travel with Sigarni, he said stoutly.
Reaching up, he took hold of her hand.
Then, let it begin, said Taliesin.
The old wizard closed his eyes and spoke softly in a language unknown to either of the Highlanders. It was soft and fluent, almost musical. Pale light flooded from the rectangular grooves in the rock face, which became translucent, and then transparent, and Sigani found herself staring through it at a cold grey landscape.
Step through quickly, said Taliesin. It will hold for a few seconds only.
The silver-haired woman and the dwarf stepped through the portal.
Sigarni shivered as she passed through, for it was like walking through a waterfall, cold and yet not as refreshing.
On the other side, they found themselves standing within a circle of 6 tall granite stones.
Sigarni swung round in time to see Taliesin fade away to nothing.
"Well, we are here," she said, turning back to Balistar.
The dwarf was lying on the ground, his body twitching.
"Bali, are you ill?"
His body began to writhe and stretch. Dropping her bow and loosing her pack, Sigarni knelt beside him. His limbs were thrashing around, his legs jutting now from his tiny trousers. The small doeskin boots split as his feet grew. His black leather belt snapped. Sigarni moved back from him and waited. Finally, the spasmodic twitching eased, and she found herself gazing down at a healthy young man in torn clothes and shredded boots. Part of one boot was still around the ankle like an adornment. Balistar groaned and sat up.
"What happened to me?" he asked.
Then he saw his arms, full length and strong, with long, slender fingers, and his legs. He scrambled to his feet and found himself staring into Sigarni's eyes.
"Oh, God! Dear God!" he said. "I'm a man!"
Throwing his arms around the stunned Sigarni, he kissed her cheek.
"I'm a man," he said again. "Look at me, Sigarni. You look very fine," she said with a smile. "Truly, this is a magical place. He said my worst nightmare awaited me. How wrong can a man be? This is everything I dreamt of. Now I will be able to stand with others and fight the Outlanders. No more jibes and cruel jokes. Oh, Sigarni!"
Abruptly, he sat down and began to weep. "I brought a spare tunic and leggings," said Sigarni. "I think they might fit you. Even if they don't, they'll look better than the rags you're wearing." He nodded and moved to her pack.
"I could even get married," he said, "and sire sons, tall sons."
"You always were handsome, Bali, and you'll make a fine father. Now stop talking and get dressed. We must be moving on."
Sigarni gazed at the bleak landscape. The sky was slate grey and the air smelt acrid. Far to the east you could see fires on the horizon as 2 distant volcanoes spewed hot ash and lava out over the land.
"Not a hospitable place," she said.
"I think it's wonderful," said Balistar.
She turned to see him struggling out of his ruined leggings.
"By heaven, Bali, has that grown also?"
He giggled.
"No, it was always this big. Do you like it?"
She laughed.
"Cover it, you fool."
Balistar dressed and tied the thongs of his new green leggings.
"They are a little tight," he said. "Am I as tall as Fel?"
"No, but you are taller than Bakris and Gwyn. That will have to do."
Sigarni reached for her bow and froze. The weapon had rooted itself in the ground, and small, slender branches were growing from it.
"Would you look at that?" she said.
Roots were spreading out from the bow, delving into the grey, ash-covered ground.
"What about your arrows?" asked Balistar.
Sigarni swung her quiver clear and pulled a shaft from it. It was unmarked. At that moment, a single ray of sunshine seared through the ash-grey sky, a pillar of light bathing what had once been a bow and was now a swiftly growing tree. The sudden warmth was welcome, and Sigarni glanced up at the sky, enjoying the feeling of sunlight on her skin. Then it was gone. Something moved against her chest, and startled, Sigarni glanced down. The small leather pouch was bulging now, and writhing as if a large rat were inside. Swiftly she ripped it from her neck and hurled it to the ground. The leather split, and a white bone protruded, others joining to it. As with Balistar, the bones stretched and grew, cartilage and ligaments slithering over them, pulling joints into sockets. At last, a huge skeleton lay on the volcanic ash.
For a moment, nothing more happened. Then suddenly, in a vivid burst of colour, red muscle and sinew, flesh and veins danced along its frame, covering lungs and liver, heart and kidneys. Skin flowed over the whole, and silver hair sprouted from head and chin. For a while, Iron Hand lay naked on the ground, then took a long, shuddering breath. His eyes opened, and he saw Sigarni.
"I can feel," he said, "the ground beneath me, the air in my lungs. How is this possible?"
"I have no idea," said Sigarni, removing her green cloak. She cut a hole in the center and passed it to the naked man. Iron Hand stood and looped it over his head.
"Where are we?"
"In the land of Yurvale," Sigarni told him. "Taliesin sent us through a magical gateway."
"It is puzzling," he said. "But by Grievac, it is good to feel again, and to have two good hands of flesh and blood," he added, clenching his fists. "Who is this?" he asked, turning to the young man at her side. "It is me, Balistar the dwarf. The magic made me grow, though not as tall as you," he added with a frown.
Iron Hand chuckled.
"You are tall enough, boy. What now, daughter?"
She pointed to the twin peaks. "We make for the city and find the crown."
Yos Shiel had been a Black River trader for more than 270 years, and remembered with great regret the ending of all that was beautiful in Yurvale. He had been celebrating his 24th birthday when the first mountain had erupted, spewing molten lava down the hillside, destroying the vineyards and the cornfields. It had been a bitter summer. First the war, and then the natural upheavals which hid the sun from the sky. Year by year it had grown steadily worse. Yos Shiel pushed his thin fingers through his thick white hair and stared out of the window at the quay, where men were loading supplies onto one of the three barges he would send down to Zervac after dusk. Smoked fish and timber, the only two items of any worth in Yurvale. Yos Shiel sold them for gold and water, in the vain hope that one day gold would be a viable currency once more. The old man rose and stretched. From his window, he saw a single ray of sunshine to the south, and his heart swelled. How long since there had been a break in the clouds? A year? Two? Several of the loaders saw it also, and all ceased their work. A young man, seeing Yos Shiel at the window, called out,
"Is it a sign, master? Is the sun returning?"
The pillar of light vanished.
"I do not look for signs any more," he said softly.
Stepping out into the dull light, he counted the barrels of fish.
"There should be 50, he said.
A huge man wearing a red shirt embroidered with gold moved into sight.
"Two were spoiled," he said,
his voice low, rumbling like distant thunder. Yos Shiel looked into the man's small, round eyes. He knew Chris Yen was lying, but the man was a thug, and he suspected a killer. The two guards Yos Shiel had appointed to supervise the loads had mysteriously disappeared. He feared them dead.
"Very well, Chris Yen. Carry on."
With a contemptuous smile, the big man swung away.
"I should never have employed him," thought Yos Shiel. "He and his brothers will strip me of all I have. I will be lucky to escape with my life."
Glancing up at the iron sky, he suddenly smiled.
"What is life worth now?" he wondered. "Would I miss it?"
Soldiers manned the ramparts of the stockade, and Yos Shiel considered asking them for help in dealing with Chris Yen. The supplies he sent were vital to the city, and his plea deserved to be heard. But then,
deserve has nothing to do with it, he realized.
Chris Yen had made friends with the officers, giving them presents.
If I go to them and they turn against me, my death will come all the sooner, he thought.
Strolling to the edge of the quay, he stared down into the inky depths of the river. No fish swam there now. The fleets were forced to put out far to sea in order to make their catches. The barge from the city came into sight, its cargo of barrels lashed to the deck, fresh drinking water cleaned in the charcoal filters of Zervak, and fresh meat for the soldiers. Yoshiel wandered back to his small office and continued working on his ledgers. Just before noon, he heard a commotion from outside and saw his workers moving towards the stockade gates. Yoshiel closed the books, cleaned the quill pen, and followed them. The gates were open, and three people had entered the stockade, two men and a woman. The woman was silver-haired and strikingly beautiful. Beside her was a giant in an ill-fitting green tunic, tied at the waist with what looked like an old bowstring. He too was silver-haired. The last of the trio was a young man dressed in green trews and a shirt too small for him.
"Where are you from?"
asked Christian, pushing to the front of the crowd and standing before the woman, his hands on his hips. "South," she said. "We're looking for a passage into the city."
"And how will you pay me?"
The woman produced a small gold coin, and Christian laughed.
"That's no good here, my pretty. It doesn't put food in mouths any longer. I'll tell you what I'll do. You and me will go to the warehouse and we'll arrange something."
"We'll find passage elsewhere," she said, turning away. One of Christiane's brothers stepped forward, grabbing her arm.
"There's nowhere else. You better listen to him," he said.
"Take your hand off my arm," said the woman icily. The man laughed.
"Or what?"
The woman ducked her head, hammering her brow into his nose. The man released her and staggered back, but she leapt, her foot cracking against his chin and catapulting him back into the crowd. Yoshiel saw the soldiers watching from the ramparts, but they made no move to interfere.
"That was an assault," yelled Christian. "Take her."
Several men rushed forward. The woman downed the first with a straight left. The smaller of her companions rushed in and threw himself at the others. He and several men tumbled to the ground.
"That's enough,"
bellowed the silver-bearded giant. The sound boomed across the stockade, and all activity ceased as he stepped in close to Christian.
"Well," he said, "you seem to be the lead bull of the pox-ridden herd. Perhaps you and I should decide the issue."
Christian said nothing, but his huge fist hammered into the man's chin. The giant took the blow and did not move. He merely grinned.
"By God, son, if that is the best you have on offer, you are in serious trouble," he said.
Christian tried to throw a left, whereupon the giant blocked it with his right and slapped Christian open-handed across the cheek. The sound was like snapping timber. Christian staggered to his right, then head down rushed the giant. The charge was met by a right cross that smashed Christian's jaw and spun him from his feet. He hit the ground face down, twitched once, and was still.
"A chin like crystal," muttered the giant. "Any more for the free?"
No one moved. The man walked to the unconscious Christian and calmly removed the embroidered red shirt. Pulling off his own tunic, he donned the garment.
"A little tight," he said, "but it will do."
Without hurry, he stripped Christian naked and clothed himself in the man's leather leggings and black boots.
"That feels better,"
he said. "No."
"Who is in charge here?"
Yoshiel stepped from the crowd.
"I am, sir." "Then it is with you we should discuss passage?"
"It is, and you are welcome to travel free of any charges."
"Good. That is most hospitable. I am Ironhand. This is my daughter Sigarni and her friend Ballastar." "I can see why you earned your name," said Yoshiel.
Yoshiel offered his guests wine and food, and if he was offended by their refusal to eat, he did not show it. Ballastar liked the little old man and listened with relish as he told of his troubles with Christian.
I don't believe he will cause you more trouble for a while yet, said Ironhand. But if you'll take my advice, you'll promote a man to take his place immediately, and then dismiss all of his henchmen.
I shall, said Yoshiel, although I would be grateful if you could stay beside me while I do the deed.
Gladly, promised Ironhand. I was amazed that Chris Yen fell so swiftly to you. I have seen him break men's arms and cudgel them down with hammer blows from his fists.
They breed them tough where we come from, said Ballistar.
And where is that?
Asked Yoshiel.
South,
answered Ballistar vaguely, wishing he'd kept his mouth shut.
We are from another world, Yoshiel, said Tigani, moving to sit on the desk opposite the old man. We pass through a magical gateway.
The trader smiled, waiting for the end of the joke. When it didn't come, his smile vanished.
You are wizards?
No, said Tigani, but a wizard sent us. We have come to reclaim something that was lost in this world, and return it to our own.
The sunlight?
Said the old man.
That was you in the south? What did you do?
I don't know what you mean, said Tigani. You mean the break in the clouds?
Yes. It has been years since we've seen the sun. Can you make it come at will?
I did nothing, Yoshiel. It was merely my bow. The wood began to sprout leaves and root itself in the soil. Then the sun shone.
We had wizards once. Old temple of them. They supervised the building of the great library in Zorvak. They were blamed when the sun went away and sacrificed on the high altar. The king promised that with their deaths the mountain would stop spewing fire, but it didn't happen. In the last 200 years, there have been other prophets who claimed that blood sacrifice would appease the gods and they would relent of their punishment, but they have not. We are a dying people, Sigarni. There is no hope for us.
And yet amid all this turmoil, you fight a war, she said. Why?
It was originally over a woman. The king's grandfather fell in love with a noblewoman from the east, but she was betrothed to the king of Kalvak. Despite her pleas, her father made her honor her promise and she was sent to Kalvak. Our king was furious and swore he would free her. We went to war. Our troops attacked Kalvak and were repulsed. Then the first of the mountains exploded. Each side blamed the other for the catastrophe, claiming that treachery had alienated the gods against us. At first it wasn't too terrible. The summers got shorter and less warm, but crops still grew. But gradually the sky turned darker, and fine ash was deposited over the farmlands. Food grew scarce, save for the fish, but even these are swimming far from shore now.
Yet the war goes on, said Ironhand. How is it that neither side has won? You said the battle was begun by the king's grandfather. How long ago was that?
A little more than 240 years. Most of the principal players are now dead, though the war goes on for other reasons. People need to eat.
They eat the corpses, whispered Ballistar.
It is a little like pork, I am told, said Yoshiel. I've not eaten it myself, but when the time comes, I don't doubt that I shall. Life is always sweet. Even in the hell of your veil.
The old man sighed.
But tell me, my friend, what is the object you seek? I may be of some assistance.
The crown of Alwyn, said Tigani.
I know of no such object.
It is a winged helm, bright silver embossed with gold.
The paradise helm, said Yoshiel,
his eyes widening.
You cannot take that. It is all that gives the people hope.
Every 25 years it shows us a vision of paradise. Waterfalls and green trees and a multitude standing around it, happy and smiling. That is our most prized artifact.
Tigani laid her hand on the old man's shoulders.
What you see is my people standing by the Alwyn Falls. Every quarter of a century the crown reappears there, shimmering over the water. We all gather to see it, and you, in turn, it seems, gather to see us. Tell me, Yoshiel, of the last time the sun shone.
It was on the day of the old king's burial. I was there as they laid him on the funeral ship and sent it blazing on the river. The clouds broke, and the sun shone for a full day. It was magnificent. There was singing and dancing in the streets.
And before that?
I don't remember exactly. Wait, yes, I do. 12 years ago, at the Feast of Atheling, we saw the dawn on the following day, the sun huge and red. That lasted only minutes.
What happened on the next feast day?
You don't understand. The Feast of Atheling corresponds with the public display of the Paradise Helm. It happens only 4 times a century.
For some time, Tsigane questioned the old man, and soon Ballistar became bored with the dialogue. He wandered to the window, leaned on the sill, and watched the barges being loaded. At last the conversation died away, and Ironhand broke in.
"Best bring your men in for dismissal, old fellow," he said, "for we have a hankering to be on one of those barges when it pulls away."
"Yes, I will," said Yoshiel. "Thank you." An hour later, the three sat at the stern of a 40-foot barge as the crew poled it steadily upriver. The vessel was fortified by hinged wooden flaps along both rails, which could be raised to offer protection from an assault. Huge rocks had been left at intervals along both sides of the deck, ready to be hurled down on any boat that sought to impede the barge's progress. Armed men sat at the prow, and all of the barge workers carried long knives.
"So, we find the temple and steal the crown," said Ballistar. "It would be best to enter it at night."
Tsigane rose, stretched, and walked away down the port side of the vessel. A soldier smiled at her.
"Stay with your friends," he said. "Soon it will be so dark you will not be able to see your hand before your face."
She thanked him and returned to the others, seating herself on a coil of rope. The light faded fast, and soon the barge was engulfed in a darkness so complete that Tsigane felt an edge of panic.
"It's like being dead,"
whispered Ballistar. Tsigane felt his hand brush against her arm. She took hold of it and squeezed his fingers.
"No, it isn't," said Ironhand. "Death is not dark. It is bright and vile."
"How can they see to steer?" Ballistar asked.
"Quiet back there," came a voice. "We'll see the city within an hour."
There was little sensation of movement within the all-encompassing blackness, and Tsigane found herself thinking back to her days with Fel, when they had hunted together and made love before the fire. He had been able to read her mood so well. There were times when she had wanted nothing more than to curl up beside him, stroking his skin. On such occasions he would hug her and kiss her fondly.
On other nights, when the fey mood was upon her, she would desire to make love with passion and fire. Always he responded.
"I was good for you too, Fel," she thought. "I knew you, your thoughts and your dreams." The first kiss had been shared on the slopes of Hydruin, on a bright summer's day. They had raced over the 4 miles from Goring's Rock to the White Stream. Fel was faster and stronger, but his staying power could not match Sigani's. She had doggedly clung to his trail, always keeping him in sight until the last long rise. Then, as he faltered, she drew on her reserves and passed him. At the White Stream, he had sunk back to his haunches and fought for breath. Tsigane brought him water in a hastily made cup of bark.
"You are a wonder, Tsigane,"
he said at last, taking her hand and kissing it. She sat beside him, looping her arm around his neck.
"My poor Fel, is your pride damaged beyond repair?"
He looked at her quizzically.
"Why would my pride be hurt? I did my best."
"I liked it when you kissed my hand," she said, changing the subject.
then I shall do it again.
I would like it more if you kissed my mouth.
He smiled then.
You are very forward for a Highland girl. I shall put it down to Gwalchmai's poor teaching. I don't mind losing a race to a woman like you, but it is not meet for you to do the seducing.
Why?
Because I sat up through most of the night, trying to think of a way to get you to kiss me. It makes a mockery of all my planning.
Sigani lay back on the soft grass.
Not at all. Go ahead. Show me your strategy.
He chuckled.
Too late. I think the fox is already in the hen house.
Even so, I would like to hear it.
Rolling to his elbow, he lay beside her, looking down.
I wanted to tell you that I have never known anyone like you, and that when I am with you, I am happier than at any other time. You are the delight of my life, Sigarni. Now and always.
You've won me over with your fine words, she said.
Now, the kiss, if you please.
Ballistar's voice cut through her thoughts.
Your hand is very warm, he whispered.
I was thinking good thoughts, she told him, keeping her voice low.
The journey continued, until at last they could see the faint lights of the city ahead. The barge moved on, approaching an arched portcullis gate. The helmsman flashed a signal with his lantern, which was answered from above the arch. Then, with a great creaking and groaning, the portcullis rose, and the barge passed beneath it. Lanterns hung from poles all along the quayside, and Sigani heard Ballister breathe a sigh of relief.
It was awful, he said, like being blind.
It was not awful, said Sigani wistfully.
The barge clanked against the stone quay. Ironhand was the first ashore, followed by Sigani and Ballistar.
What now?
Asked the warrior. We'll find some sheltered place to sleep, Sigani told him. Tomorrow we'll see the king.
For what purpose? Ballistar asked.
I shall ask for the crown to be returned.
And he will just give it to you?
Of course not, Bali. I shall offer him something in return.
It will need to be a very large gift,
Ironhand pointed out.
It will be, she promised.
Chapter 12 The city was unlike anything Sigarni had ever seen. Crammed together, the houses reared like cliff faces, dotted with lighted windows. Narrow alleyways filtered off like veins in the flesh of a stone giant. Arched tunnels led deeper into the city, and these boasted oil lamps, hung at regular intervals to guide the traveller. There were signs on every alley, giving names to the streets and the wider avenues that led off from them. Sigarni felt hemmed in, and dwarfed by the colossal nature of Servac. Ironhand was less impressed.
They have structures in Kushir of far greater beauty, he said, and there is evidence at least of planning there. These huge hovels give a man no space to breathe.
It is oppressive, agreed Ballistar. They wandered on aimlessly for a while, until they saw the lights of a tavern. Ironhand headed for it.
Wait, called Ballistar. Who will we pee?
I'll think of something, said Ironhand.
The tavern was more than half empty, and few diners sat at the rough-built tables. There was a long, timbered drinking area at which several men stood, downing ale. Ironhand moved to the bar, and a serving maid approached him. She was extraordinarily fat, her mouth turned down at the corners, her eyes small and seemingly set in several acres of unnecessary flesh. Her enormous breasts sagged over the bar.
"What is there on offer?"
asked Ironhand, as Sigarni and Ballistar moved alongside.
"To eat or to drink or both," she countered, idly wiping at the counter with a stained rag.
"Just a drink," said the silver-bearded giant.
"We have ale or water, or if you'd rather something hot, we have a dry root to Zane."
"And with what do we pee?"
"What?
What currency do we need? We are strangers here, and have been told that gold is of no use.
You don't pay, she said, as if talking to someone retarded. Everything's free. Have been for years. So, what'll it be?
Eel, said Ironhand.
I'll have water, said Sigani. Where can we find lodgings for the night?
Wherever you choose. There's a room upstairs that you're welcome to. There's no fire, mind, no wood, you see, but the oil lamps keep the room warm enough. There's only one bed, but it's big enough for the two of you, she said, gesturing towards Balistar and Sigani. As for him, well, I could always share your bed, my pretty, said Ironhand. I expect it's a large one.
The cheek of the man, said the woman, blushing.
Those that don't ask never get, said Ironhand with a wink, and you've no idea how long it's been since I've enjoyed the company of a handsome woman.
Handsome, indeed. I was a fine-looking young woman, I'll have you know. Men travel far to court me, and I don't take kindly to being mocked.
I would never mock you, my lovely. I've always preferred my woman with a little meat on their bones. You think on it while you fetch us our drinks. I'm a man of considerable patience.
Ironhand turned away and strode to a nearby table, where Balistar sat alongside him.
Good God, man, how could you make love to that sow? She looks mighty good to me, lad. Now there's your sort of woman, he added, pointing to another serving maid carrying a tray to the far table.
She was slim and dark-haired, no more than 17. Balistar stared at her with undisguised longing.
I'll call her over, whispered Ironhand.
No! Squealed Balistar. It was too late, for Ironhand waved at the girl. She finished delivering the dishes to a table by the window, then walked over.
My friend here, began Ironhand.
For pity's sake, snapped Balistar. He smiled sheepishly at the maid.
I'm sorry. What he's trying to say, my lovely, continued Ironhand, is that he is smitten by your beauty. If I were a younger man, I'd fight him to the death for you. No, we are strangers in this city and have no understanding of the normal practices. It will have to suffice that he finds you astonishingly attractive and would like to spend a little time with you when you are finished with your work. What do you see?
The girl smiled and stared hard at Balistar, who felt he had reddened to his toes.
He's a handsome boy, she said, and you are an old devil. However, since you've already seduced my mother and that puts me out for the night, I think I will spend a little time with the young man. The rooms upstairs are all numbered. I shall be in room 11 in an hour or so.
Reaching out, she cupped Balistar's chin.
Your beard is soft, she said. I like that.
Her mother appeared, bearing a wooden tray on which was set a pitcher of ale, a jug of water, and 3 tankards. She set it down carefully and turned to Ironhand.
Don't be drinking too much of that, she said. It has a habit of turning hard men to softness, if you take my meaning.
Ironhand's laughter bellowed out. Grasping the woman round her ample waist, he drew her into his lap. Then, taking the pitcher, he raised it to his lips and began to drink. Balistar and Sigani watched in amazement as he downed more than half of it.
By God, that's better, he said.
Then he rose, lifted the astonished woman into the air, and began to spin and dance.
She must weigh a ton, whispered Balistar to Sigani. Who does he do that?
Ironhand returned to the table, still carrying the woman.
It's no good, he said. I can wait not a moment longer. I'll see you both in the morning.
So saying, he carried his conquest from the room. For a little while, Balistar and Sigani sat in silence. At last he spoke.
The woman I'm going to see, I don't... What should I...
Sigani laughed softly.
do whatever comes naturally. Sit with her and talk for a while. My advice would be to tell her that she is your first, and that you are unskilled.
I couldn't do that.
She will know anyway. Enjoy yourself, Ballastar, and make sure that she too has fond memories of the meeting. Too many men get carried away by their lust and forget that their partners need loving too.
How do I?
This is not a lesson, Bali. Kiss, touch, and explore. Make it last. This is the one experience you will never forget. He grinned.
I can't believe this. When we get back, I'm going to pick up the little wizard and kiss both his wizened cheeks.
He'll turn you into a spider and tread on you.
Will you be all right alone?
Leaning forward, she covered his hand with her own.
I stood in a cave and waited for demons, Bali. I think I'll probably survive a night in a strange inn. Don't you?
They sat and talked for a while. Then the young maid came for Ballastar, and Tsigani smiled at the look of sudden panic that flashed across his handsome face.
Go, she said. Enjoy yourself.
Alone now, she sipped the water and concentrated on the magical events that had overtaken them in Yorvale. 3 separate bursts of magic. The growth of Ballastar, the sprouting of the bow, and the rebirth of Ironhand. The dwarf had become a man, strong and straight. Why? And why the bow and not the arrows? She had tried to discuss it with Ballastar, but he had merely shrugged and said,
"It was magic. Who cares why?"
That there must be laws governing magic, she thought. Ironhand had been reborn through a piece of dried bone, but what of the bone tips on her arrows? And why had they not grown into deer? And the leather of her belt or boots, why had these items remained intact? Taliesin had warned that this was a world of strong magic, and that it would affect them far more than the inhabitants of Yorvale. What had he said about his fellow sorcerer? He had eaten pork, and it had swelled inside him. Tsigani shuddered. Like the bone of Ironhand, the flesh had reconstituted itself in his belly, and he had been ripped to pieces from within by a live and panic-stricken boar. Reaching for the water goblet, she winced as the cold metal edge pushed at the still healing cut on her palm. And instantly, she had the answer. On the night before the journey, she had held Ironhand's bone. On the journey itself through the gateway, she had gripped Ballastar's hand. My blood touched them. The bow also, but not the arrows. Tsigani rose from her seat and walked upstairs to her room. The bed was deep and soft, but she did not sleep for several hours. When she awoke, Ironhand was sitting beside the bed.
I hope your dreams were good ones, he said.
I had none that I can recall, she told him. You?
I didn't sleep a wink, he said with a grin, but I could eat a horse.
That would not be advisable. The horse would eat you.
He looked at her quizzically, and she explained about Taliesin's warning.
Well, then, we had better find the crown and head back to the Highlands. I want to taste a good steak again and smell the pines.
First, we must find the palace, or wherever it is that the king resides.
You think he'll just give you a national treasure?
We'll see.
The king stared from the window of his 8th-floor study and watched as the enemy siege engine slowly approached the city's north wall. There were 7 of them, each around 80 feet high, clad in sheets of hammered iron and impervious to flame arrows. When they reached the walls, which they would within the hour, the fighting would be hard. Close to the wall, the towers would lower their drawbridges, and fighting men would pour out onto the ramparts. His guards would meet them, blade to blade, hacking and slaying, buying time for the engineers to hurl firebombs through the apertures. The iron cladding outside would offer no protection to the scores of men waiting on the siege tower stairs.
You are coming to your doom,
he told himself. He glanced to his left, where his ceremonial armor was laid out on a bench of oak.
You are getting too old to fight, he thought, and what will happen to Zorvac when you fall in battle?
Neither of his sons had yet reached 100,
and even if they had, he thought with regret, they could not shoulder the responsibilities of command. Perhaps I have been too easy on them.
Stepping back from the window, he moved to his desk, lifting a bronze-rimmed oval mirror. The face that peered back at him was grey with fatigue, the eyes dull. Dropping the mirror, he picked up the letter that had arrived the previous evening from the merchant, Yosh Shiel. Three strangers had come to the city, intent on stealing the Paradise Helm. They would find a fine surprise waiting for them. A servant entered the room and bowed deeply.
"Majesty, there is a woman who wishes to see you.
Tell her I have no time today. Let her make her entreaty to Peizan Yal."
"With respect, Majesty, I feel you may wish to speak with a woman. She says she wishes to see you in connection with the Paradise Helm, and she matches the description you gave to the soldiers."
The king turned.
"Is she alone?"
"No, her companions are with her, Majesty, a white-haired giant and a young man."
"Are they armed?"
"They gave their weapons to the royal sentries."
Intrigued, the king moved to his desk.
"Show them in, and fetch Peizan Yal."
Bowing once more, the servant departed. As Yosh Shiel had reported, the woman was very beautiful, and moved with a grace that stirred the king's blood.
"I understand you claim to be from another land," he said. "Where might that be?"
"I could not say where, in relation to your veil," she told him, her voice deep, almost husky. "We were sent through a magical gateway." The king picked up the letter.
"So Yosh Shiel tells me. I must say I find it hard to believe. Could it be that you are spies sent by the enemy?"
A squad of guards moved in behind the newcomers.
"You wish them arrested, Majesty?"
asked Peizan Yal. "Not yet,"
the king told the young guardsman.
"They interest me. So, tell me, woman, why you are here."
"To bring back the sun," she said.
The silence in the room grew as the listeners took in her words.
"You are a witch?"
asked the king.
"I am."
"Sorcery has long been considered a crime here, punishable by death."
The woman smiled.
"Whereas stupidity is obviously not. Do you wish to see the sunshine over your veil?"
The king leaned back in his chair.
"Let us suppose, merely for the sake of argument, that you could achieve this miracle. What do you desire in return?"
"I think the letter from Yosh Shiel will answer that," she told him.
"You know of that, and yet you come here. Was that wise, witch?"
She shrugged. "The wisdom of any course can only be judged by the outcome. I offer you the sun for a piece of metal. You make whatever choice seems fitting."
"What do you think, Peizan?"
asked the king.
The young guardsman gave a derisory laugh. "I think they are spies, father. Let me interrogate them."
"Yet another numbskull,"
said Iron Hand to Sigani, in the same tone of voice.
"You think they're all victims of inbreeding?"
The guardsman's sword snaked from its scabbard.
"Put it away, boy,"
said Iron Hand,
"before I take it away from you and swat your backside."
The guardsman took a deep breath and dropped into a fighting position with sword extended.
"That's enough,"
said the king.
"Put up your blade, Peizan."
"You heard what he said, father?"
I did,"
answered the king, wearily.
"So let us not be too swift to prove his point."
"I think a little proof would not go amiss," put in Sigani to the king. "Do you have a garden here?"
"Nothing grows in Zervak,"
he said.
"But yes, there was a garden. I do not go there now, for the sight of it saddens me."
"Take me there," she said, "and I will show you something to lift your heart."
The king stood and moved to the window, where the siege towers were inching ever closer. He swung back to the woman.
"Very well. I will humor you. But know this, if there is no miracle, I shall not be best pleased, and the charge of sorcery will be laid against you.
If there is no miracle, said the woman, then the charge will be hard to prove.
For the first time, the king smiled. Let us go to the garden, he said. The garden was more than 200 feet long, and had been designed around a series of winding white-paved pathways. There were 3 fountains, none of them in use, and the flower beds were covered with thick grey ash. Scores of dead trees lined the marble walls at the outer edges of the garden, and the area was devoid of any life. Sigani felt a moment of fear as she surveyed the landscape. What if her reasoning was flawed?
I'm looking forward to this, said Iron Hand with a wink. Well, said the king, we are here, and you promised a miracle.
He was standing with his arms folded, his son beside him with hand on sword. The 6 guards stood nervously by. Sigani approached the king.
May I borrow your dagger, my lord? She asked.
What nonsense is this?
Stormed the young man at his side. Sigani frowned, then raised her arm before him.
Make a shallow cut here, she said, pointing to her forearm.
Peisan Yol drew his dagger and drew the blade slowly across her skin. Blood welled, and Sigani walked to a line of dead bushes, kneeling down before the first and holding her arm above the dry branches. Slowly, drops of blood dripped to the wood. Nothing happened. Sigani stayed where she was and glanced at Iron Hand, who was watching her intently. She had explained her theory to him, and he had listened thoughtfully.
Well, where is this miracle?
Asked the king, his tone hardening. Iron Hand stepped forward and knelt beside Sigani.
Touch the bush, he whispered.
Lowering her arm, her fingers brushed against the wood, and she felt her hand grow hot. The blood upon the branches disappeared into the grey wood, which began to swell and grow. Buds appeared, pushing out into new red growth, stretching up towards the iron sky, then darkened to green, and finally to brown. 3 blooms appeared, opening to roses the colour of Sigani's blood. She stood and turned towards the king, ready to present her arguments. Just then, a beam of sunlight pierced the clouds, illuminating the garden. In its bright light, the king looked older, more weary, his face lined, dark rings beneath his eyes.
How have you done this?
He whispered, moving to the rose and kneeling before it to smell the blooms.
The war must end, she said. That is all that keeps the sun at bay.
What are you saying?
This is a magical land, Majesty, where the war and the devastation feed the dark side of the magic. Every act of hate, of malice, of bloodlust only serves to fuel the fires beneath the mountains. You are destroying this world with your fighting. Think back to the days before, when the sun shone, the Feast of Atheling. There was a 3-day truce between the armies. When the fighting stopped, the sun shone. It was the same when your father was buried. A day of truce, and before the war, your vale was a paradise. Can you not see it? In some way, the feelings of the people are magnified by the land itself. All this hatred and violence is reflected by the land which, like the people here, is turning on itself.
I told you she was a spy, roared Peisan Yol. This is all a trick to lull us.
From some distance away came a series of dull, booming sounds, and the faint clash of steel upon steel. The sunlight faded away.
The siege towers have reached the walls, said the king. I must go now, but I will give your word serious consideration, and we will meet again this afternoon. In the meantime, I will ask one of my servants to show you the palace museum. There are many wonders there, including the helm you seek.
Sigani and Ballistar bowed. Ironhand merely inclined his head.
Your tall friend does not care for the formalities. Does he not know it is